Word of mouth.
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 This is Word of Mouth from New Hampshire Public Radio. I'm Virginia Prescott. Coming up, famous for all the wrong reasons, we'll run down some of history's beloved, yet notoriously bad writers, musicians, and artists. And on the other end of the spectrum, author Megan Abbott, a new head girl in the literary set. Her new novel is pure noir, with a murder upsetting the balance of a high school cheerleading squad. And Farewell My Cubicle, a musical follows the anxieties and epiphanies of an unemployed office worker. But first, the blackout boom. A pair of colossal power failures in India this week deprived more than 600 million people of electricity, almost twice the population of the United States. Before you think, oh, that's India, that could never happen here, remember those June storms that knocked power out for about a week in parts of mid-Atlantic states? That blackout renewed calls for upgrading America's electric grid and accusations that the power industry lags behind in investment and innovation. Who should make those multi-billion dollar investments, the public or private sector, is caught up in a debate now dividing American politics. Lisa Marganelli explores the power struggle in an article for Pacific Standard magazine. We spoke with her a few days before the disaster in India and asked if blackouts here in the U.S. are happening more frequently than in the past.
Yes, there's something called the Eaton Blackout Tracker, which has found that in 2011 there were 3,000 outages. In 2008 there were just 2,169. And the number of people affected by the blackouts has changed. The number of big blackouts affecting more than 50,000 people a year has doubled since the 90s. The drain on the economy ranges from $80 billion to $180 billion a year from blackouts. And that's an estimate from Masood Amin, who's at the University of Minnesota and has spent decades watching the grid and making estimates about its effects.
That's a big loss. Do we know what kind of investments and costs would have to be made to bring the grid up to snuff?
We need big investments. Roughly, I think the amount is around $24 billion per year over the next 20 years, which sounds like a lot. But when you think about how much of our economy is underwritten by the electrical grid, it's not that much. The other thing is that these investments of between $17 and $24 billion over the next 20 years would probably save about $49 billion in outage costs per year and perhaps another $20 billion in increased energy efficiency. So in a sense, by making these investments, we could save money. But what we don't have is the political will to really make these investments across the grid.
And I know we've had a couple of very bad storms up here in New Hampshire in the past few years, ice storms and summer storms. People here are buying generators, or many have gone off the grid. So is that a workable solution to America's power problem?
If you want to keep your own lights on, yes. But in terms of our whole project of keeping everyone's lights on, no, it's not. If we make the grid smarter, we can then take more power from solar, from wind. We can let people install generators in their homes that, for example, heat your water, create heat and create electricity, and then you can throw that back on the grid and sort of cooperate with the grid. But we need a much more complex grid to be able to accept that. Without that, with each person kind of withdrawing to their own gated community and they're, you know, going off the grid, what you have is you have people relying on the grid in good times and then separating from the grid in bad times. You know, the grid is almost like a living organism. It's been described as the world's most complicated machine.
Well, okay, let's get back to that political will. You sort of illuminate that by giving us some of the history of the centralized infrastructure that does provide power in the U.S. How did that initial investment come to be?
Well, you know, it's a really interesting thing. When we first started electrifying homes and businesses back at the turn of the century, basically power companies would start up and they would find a little network of people who they thought could pay, people and businesses, and they'd string some wires around. So you didn't really have a grid. Everything looked kind of like an asterisk, you know. It wasn't a grid. It was just there was a power source and then there were wires running out to the individual light bulbs, basically. And then as power sort of became a little, you know, as there became a few appliances, a little bit more than a light bulb, you saw new power companies going in and installing power, but really only in the richer areas or in the upper middle class areas. And when FDR came in as governor of New York, he made this promise, what he called the waffle iron campaign, which was that every house should be able to have a waffle iron, which is such a funny dream for, you know, now it's like, what, a waffle iron? Who wants a waffle iron? But of course, we have everything in the world now, because basically he set up this structure saying, look, if you want to have a monopoly on customers, you need to set up lines so that you provide the power to every single customer. And so they basically set up this system where they had a regulator in each state for power, and that regulator made decisions, but they awarded all the customers in the state or in that area to one power company. So they awarded monopolies in exchange. They had regulators. And so this waffle iron campaign then kind of grew into FDR's broader vision of putting in the TVA and the Bonneville Power Authority, you know, these huge hydroelectric dams that provided power to everybody and got the government more into the field of both controlling floods and supplying power, producing power. But that essential relationship of the government being a regulator and requiring that power companies serve everyone was sort of the start of this more democratic sense of power. And it also explains how we had private investment and this public-private partnership that has really been very successful in delivering power to us up until relatively recently when these outages started. And what's happened over the years is that the power company itself, because it's regulated, the power companies, they have many different sorts of agendas, and they have different kinds of regulation also. The kind of liberal idea that animated the grid in the beginning, which was that we would have power for all and that would be good for everyone, has kind of fallen away. The power companies themselves invest very, very little in research and development, about 0.17 of their profits. It's like on par with the dog food industry. It's very, very, I mean, they're basically a low-tech industry with a very, very high-tech function.
Lisa Marganelli, a research fellow at the New America Foundation who writes about energy policy. For a link to her article on political gridlock and the grid from Pacific Standard, go to wordofmouthradio.org. Among other disasters dominating the news this summer have been record-breaking droughts and some of the most destructive wildfires ever experienced in the American West. In New Hampshire this year, wildfires have burned fewer than 200 acres, damaging some 12 buildings and injuring 3 people. Not all forest fires are unwelcome, however, especially for species that depend on recently burned land for their habitats. As NHPR's Sam Evans-Brown reports, wildlife officials are so concerned about the lack of fires here that they're igniting a few of their own.
If you want to get an idea what some parts of New Hampshire used to look like, you've got to find a spot where people don't live, like alongside an airport runway. It's kind of a grassy and bushy terrain that's dense with low bush blueberries and pocked with scrub oaks and shrubs. And these pine barrens are a habitat that depends on fire to exist. So it's the perfect spot for firefighter cadets like David Tommaso to learn how to fight wildfires, as they did this past May.
There was actually a fire here that got out of control. I went a little farther than they expected. I don't know if you heard about that.
Are you kind of hoping that's going to happen?
Yeah, I'm kind of hoping that'll happen today, but we'll see.
They rake a 3-foot swath of ground, leaving it bare of sticks and leaves.
A small break like this in the fuel will stop the fire that's burning on the surface.
And then light it up. A line of cadets with backpack water sprayers keep the 6-inch high flames firmly under control.
Step and sweep! Go! Go! Go!
This is what's called a prescribed burn. And forest rangers estimate that between 100 and 400 acres a year are burned this way in New Hampshire. Before land was developed in the state, large fires used to sweep through regularly. Native Americans used to set fires to clear underbrush and create good hunting grounds. And according to forest ranger Brian Noel, in the first half of the 1900s, when logging operations were in full swing, fires used to be huge.
Oh, hundreds to thousands of acres.
Think about this. This spring's big fire that made the headlines, it burned only 86 acres. Now, fires just don't spread as far. Roads crisscross the forest, serving as fire breaks, and there are more better-trained firefighters and simply more people watching for smoke. Noel says that the average wildfire in New Hampshire burns around a half acre. That's great news if you want to live in a house surrounded by trees. But there are downsides.
It was a stand of scrub oak for many years, and so now we're trying to knock down some of the scrub oak and create grassy areas to put lupin in the future.
Back along the airport runway, Fish and Game's Heidi Holman says the prescribed burns help train firefighters, and they also make it possible for lupin to grow, which the endangered state butterfly, the Karner Blue, needs to survive.
This is the lupin.
And that's the only thing...
The only thing
that
they
Karner
will eat.
Blue eats.
Yep.
So, preserving the state butterfly means protecting and creating habitat for this delicate plant. A couple of months after the burn took place, Holman comes back to the scene, and it's hard to tell that it ever occurred. The blueberries and the chokeberry bushes are already 6 inches high, full and green. The grass and lupin that Holman hoped for haven't really taken hold. But there are some successful patches. Holman shows me a spot where a clump of grass has sprouted and beat back the brush a bit.
Little blue stem is a clump grass. It's not like the grass in your yard. And so it actually leaves patches of exposed soil. And that's the condition that the lupin needs to germinate.
At last count, there are only about 2,600 Karner Blues left in New Hampshire. And as the forests continue to grow in and homogenize, other species that depend on a habitat that fires used to foster could find themselves squeezed out. But of course, fires are dangerous, and no one wants to see homes, or worse, lives lost in forest fires. So for the time being, these prescribed, carefully controlled burns may be the best option to preserve a diverse landscape, one where animals like the Karner Blue can survive. For Word of Mouth, I'm Sam Evans Brown.
To see photos Sam took of that prescribed burn and its aftermath, go to wordofmouthradio.org. Coming up, artists who set the bar low, really low. We'll get a rundown of some of the most successfully bad singers, poets, and artists who didn't let good taste get in the way of their passion. That's when Word of Mouth continues in just a minute. This is Word of Mouth from New Hampshire Public Radio. I'm Virginia Prescott. Most artists do hope that their work will someday be recognized by the public, admired by critics, maybe even remembered by historians. Even 2 out of 3 ain't bad. Ouch. Word of Mouth regular Clay Wirestone compiled a list of history's most well-known but worst-received artists for the July-August issue of Mental Floss magazine. He's here to run through some memorable creative fails. I don't know if I can thank you for this, Clay.
Oh, well.
Great to have you here, though.
Oh, good to be here, too.
Who are we listening to?
That's Florence Foster Jenkins, also known as the Diva of Din, as her fans called her. She wanted to be a musician from an early age, but her father really opposed that, so she wasn't able to pursue her musical education until after his death, when she was 44 years old, at which point she began a series of yearly recitals to a society audience, mainly performing kind of operatic standards like that.
Okay, so we heard that recording. Is this the first recorded example of audiences loving something purely for camp value?
Well, certainly one of the first times somebody got so famous for doing that. She put on these recitals for some 30 years, and they became legendary. She had to turn people away. You know, she made her own costumes, some of which involved angel wings. And eventually the demand grew so great that she made records like what we just heard, and she actually played Carnegie Hall at the age of 76, made a tidy amount of money, and they had to turn some 2,000 people away.
Whoa. So next on your list, the dedicated and persistent Scottish poet William Topaz McGonagall. What's his story?
Well, he was a weaver, but he was unfortunately born at the wrong place at the wrong time, which was that the Industrial Revolution was kind of sweeping through Europe at the time. His skills were becoming obsolete, and he had a wife and 7 children to support. So he had a divine revelation at the age of 47 in 1877 that he was supposed to write poetry. He had no training for this. He just started writing poems about current events, people he knew, just random subjects, and sending them to newspapers. And many times they were printed, perhaps just so people could laugh at them.
Well, we do have a bit of his best-known work here. This is called The Tay Bridge Disaster. May I read just some?
Oh, please, go ahead.
Beautiful railway bridge of the silvery Tay. Alas, I'm very sorry to say that 90 lives have been taken away on the last Sabbath day of 1879, which will be remembered for a very long time. Not exactly Robert Burns.
No, not at all. And of course, you can't forget the very last lines of the poem. For the stronger we our houses do build, the less chance we have of being killed. It's hard to argue with that, really.
So how did people respond?
Let's put it this way. He became well-known enough that circuses that were passing through Dundee would hire him to recite his poems in front of crowds, and then the crowds would throw things at him.
Regardless of whether you like the poetry, you have to admire, this guy had unflagging belief in his own work. Now, is this what inspires a cult following, Clay?
Well, absolutely. And he had friends and supporters who helped him publish a collection of his work called Poetical Gems. And it's actually still in print now. And J.K. Rowling, actually, the Harry Potter author, the headmistress of Hogwarts Academy, Minerva McGonagall, is actually named after William McGonagall.
He does indeed have a legacy, even if he's not getting any royalties.
No.
So next we have a Russian sculptor whose name I'm not going to attempt to pronounce.
Well, my attempt is Zurab Tsereteli. Yeah, he's a Russian sculptor with a real flair for the tacky. He came up through the old Soviet system, but has managed to cling to power and prominence. His best-known work is a 10-story tall statue of Peter the Great, the founder of the Russian Empire in Moscow. But for some reason, Peter is wearing Roman legionnaire garb and is standing on a ship that's on top of a tower-shaped wave. Artists and critics in Moscow hate it so much they've actually threatened to blow it up at various times.
Whoa. Now, he added some influential friends, however. Among them, President Bill Clinton, who mm-hmm. spoke at the unveiling of the 9/11 memorial that currently stands in Bayonne, New Jersey. Now, this is something that Tsereteli
yes.
designed. Would you like to describe it for
well,
us?
Well, it's called To the Struggle Against World Terrorism, and it's a giant slab of stone. There's kind of a huge crack in the middle of it. It looks maybe like it's been blown up somehow. And there's this giant metallic tear that for some reason is hanging in the middle of the crack, and there's water that pours down around it 24/7. It was originally meant for Jersey City, New Jersey, and it was going to be installed for free, and everyone was very excited until they actually saw it, at which point then they politely rejected it, and it went to another city.
That's so strange. Well, there's a link to a slideshow of his works if you disbelieve Clay's description of how bad it is. Now, finally, Clay, you discovered a fantasy novella, The Eye of Argon, that's become kind of a cult classic among genre fans for its utter ineptitude. Give us a little bit about the author.
Well, what it's mainly important to know about the author is that he was young. Jim Thies wrote this story when he was 16 years old. It was published in something called OSFAN, the Ozark Science Fiction Society's fan magazine. Probably something that was mimeographed. It had some hand-drawn illustrations to it. And, you know, I doubt he thought that anything would happen with it. But what eventually occurred was that this magazine made its way into the nascent science fiction convention circuit in the 1970s, where people just could not believe this ripely overwritten prose. It became kind of a hit.
Can you give us an example?
Here's just a sentence chosen at random. The flickering torches cast weird shafts of luminescence dancing over the half-naked harlot of his choice, her stringy orchid twines of hair swaying gracefully over the lithe opaque nose as she raised a half-drained mug to her pale red lips.
He sounds like he's more 12 than 16.
Well, and it was turned into, in these science fiction conventions, into kind of a contest. Basically, whoever won was the person who could read the story for the longest without breaking into hysterical laughter.
Well, I think you did a pretty good job. Is this story still popular among fantasy fans today?
Well,
I mean, this was back in the
70s. I don't know if I'd say popular was quite the word, but it certainly has survived. Jim Thies, unfortunately, died in 2002. He never quite came to terms with what happened to the story. He learned about it. He'd become a journalist in the interim, and I think was a little ashamed. But after his death in 2006, it was actually finally published in a paperback edition with his name misspelled on the cover.
I'm just wondering, is the message to bad artists, just keep trying. Maybe someday you'll find your audience.
I think the real message is you have to believe that you're great. All of these people, well, possibly with the exception of Jim, actually believed that they were amazing, that they were awesome. William McGonagall believed that Queen Victoria wanted him to become her official poet.
Didn't happen.
Unfortunately not.
Well, thanks so much for telling us about these epic fails.
Sure.
Clay Wirestone, he's arts editor at the Concord Monitor, and his article, The Worst at What They Do, is in the new edition of Mental Floss magazine. We do have links to some of that terrible sculpture, videos, and slideshows of everything we mentioned at wordofmouthradio.org. Coming up, everything you suspected about cheerleaders, probably true, but they do have an inner life.
Sometimes you stand under the hot gush for so long, looking at your body, counting every bruise, touching every tender place, watching the swirl at your feet, the glitter spinning, like a mermaid shedding her scales. You're really just trying to get your heart to slow down. You think, this is my body and I can make it do things. I can make it spin, blip, fly.
We'll hear more about that in just a moment. Stay with us for more Word of Mouth.
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 From New Hampshire Public Radio, this is Word of Mouth. I'm Virginia Prescott.
Missy is bank.
Bankrupt? We've already so decided on Jamie.
Courtney, this is not a democracy. It's a cheerocracy. I'm sorry, but I'm overruling you.
Kirsten Dunst there from Bring It On, a film which pretty much stamped the image of cheerleaders in contemporary culture as a perky, cliquish, and generally vapid lot. Dare Me is a new and much buzzed about book by Megan Abbott. The cheerleaders at Sutton Grove High have more to think about than their spray tans. Their pretty, hard-driving coach holds the squad in her thrall. She has less control over her own life, which opens up a dark tale of jealousy, physical and psychological abuse, and a mysterious death. Author Megan Abbott joins us now from Argo Studios in New York to tell us more. And Megan, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Oh, thanks for having me.
So you may have created a new genre with this book, the cheerleader noir genre.
I do think it's definitely new, but it shouldn't be.
Yeah, there's plenty of material there, huh?
Right, exactly.
Were you a cheerleader in high school?
No, it's sort of ironic, and anyone who knew me in high school would find it deeply so, because I was more the editor of the school paper kind of girl.
Almost an anti-cheerleader, I would
think.
Yeah,
well, yes. But cheerleading was quite different then, I have to say. It was much more, this is the 80s, it was much more of the, you know, pom-pom shake, sort of hip swinging. It wasn't the athletic pursuit that it is today. Not that I was athletic either, but it's definitely changed since then as well.
So why did you choose cheerleading then? What was the appeal?
I really stumbled upon it. In my last book, I had a character who was a field hockey player, and so I started watching some clips of girls playing field hockey, and the ferocity of them on the field and this kind of wild freedom they seemed to have was just so intriguing to me, and the idea that there might be a place for girls to have a healthy outlet for aggression and competition and ambition. And then it sort of led me to cheerleading because it's become the most dangerous high school sport.
Yeah, the danger of the sport. And there's a girl sitting on the sidelines at the squad because of an injury she sustained. And she's looking at them and realizing that when they're performing stunts, it looks like they're trying to kill each other.
Right, yes, exactly.
Is this like just the, you know, general recklessness of youth, or is there something particularly competitive or aggressive about the nature of young women?
I think it's both. I think, you know, all teenagers are a little nihilistic and also have that illusion of immortality, you know, that they really don't think anything could happen to them. But I do think it's just there's so few places where girls today are allowed to have any of these dark feelings or express them. They're just, especially the girls who end up being cheerleaders, who do tend to be the most all-American, let's just say, there's just no place for them to say bad things or to express bad thoughts. So somehow I think all that energy gets to play out doing these stunts, and that ambition, there's nothing threatening about it because they're supposed to want to do it. So it's sort of given full rein.
Well, there's plenty of room for bad thoughts inside of this book. However, and in their brains, and in the main sort of characters here, we have Beth, who's been the sort of head girl, queen bee, captain of the cheerleading squad, and her friend Addie, her forever lieutenant. This has been the relationship since Pee-wee cheerleading squads for them. And then there is the coach French, Colette French, who's this pretty, very put together new coach. She's 27 and in many ways kind of embodies what all of those girls want to be, except for Beth. There's a real battle of wills between her and Beth. What's going on there?
Your cheerleading coaches in particular tend to be not that much older than cheerleaders often, and sometimes they've just been out of high school a few years. So they're just far enough in age to be more mentorly, but not so far in age that the girls don't want to be like them and don't want to identify with them. And so the power can be really intense. And Beth, you know, as someone who has been queen bee, she distinctly had somewhat occupied that role. She's the only one who is not captivated and sees this as a real power struggle. I ended up starting to think about it as almost like a Shakespearean, you know, Richard III was kind of my model, that this would be a fight for the throne and who would hold the power and which leader would hold sway, you know, the good leader or the bad leader and which would dominate.
But we do mostly live inside of Addie Hanlon. She's the narrator. And this book was written in the first person, which is a difficult thing, especially in the present tense. It's a difficult way to tell a story. Now, why did you choose this format?
It is. I felt that it's very easy to view, especially particular cheerleading, as kitsch. It's sort of been trapped in kitsch and in pop culture and in irony. And I felt if we were in the head of someone doing it, we would have to sort of tear off those trappings. It would have to feel really real. And if we were in Addie's head in particular, she's not the queen bee. She's, you know, that sort of second-in-command person has always interested me, because you always wonder, you know, what their motive is and have they ever thought about being queen bee themselves.
Well, she may not be the queen bee, but she's pretty unapologetically a mean girl. I mean, did you worry about making her nice enough for readers?
It's so funny because people have said that to me, and of course, you go native when you write these things and you start to like everybody. And I'm sure she would have tormented me in high school, of course, but in writing her, even writing Beth, in some ways even more so Beth, I grew to love, sort of admire, and then ultimately love them, because they're so committed. They're so dedicated. You know, Addie is so full force, and I guess in the end, and they sort of seduced me.
Well, Megan, I'd love to hear you read a little bit from the book Dare Me. First, give us a little bit of background on what's going on here.
Sure. This is from the very beginning, and as you say, it's first person, so it's Addie's point of view, and she's essentially describing what it's like to come out of a competition and, you know, essentially strip off her war paint, as I sort of consider the cheerleader costume, and she sort of thinks a little bit about what cheer means to her. After a game, it takes a half hour under the shower head to get all the hairspray out, to peel off all the sequins, to dig out that last bobby pin nestled deep in your hair. Sometimes you stand under the hot gush for so long, looking at your body, counting every bruise, touching every tender place, watching the swirl at your feet, the glitter spinning, like a mermaid shedding her scales. You're really just trying to get your heart to slow down. You think, this is my body and I can make it do things. I can make it spin, blip, fly. After, you stand in front of the steaming mirror, the fuchsia streaks gone, the lashes unsparkled, and it's just you there, and you look like no one you've ever seen before. You don't look like anybody at all. At first, cheer was something to fill my days, all our days. Ages 14 to 18, a girl needs something to kill all that time, that endless, itchy waiting, every hour, every day, for something, anything to begin. There's something dangerous about the boredom of teenage girls. Coach said that once, one fall afternoon long ago. But she said it not like someone's mom or a teacher or the principal or, worst of all, a guidance counselor. She said it like she knew and understood. The more I did it, the more it owned me. It made things matter. It put a spine into my spineless life, and that spine spread into backbone, ribs, collarbone, neck held high. It was something. Don't say it wasn't. And Coach gave it all to us.
That was Megan Abbott reading from her new book, Dare Me. The book is getting quite a lot of buzz and landing on some pretty impressive reading lists, including O Magazine, Summer's Must Read, and Nick Hornby's Nightstand. That's according to an interview that he gave to Believer magazine. That just captured so well the sort of psychology and physicality of, you know, these young girls burgeoning into women, sort of craving an adult world beyond. There's such a deep appeal, but also this sense of danger.
Right. No, I do think so. And I think that's the part that's rather universal about girls. But there is something about that age that you're so much on the precipice and you have such a desire to experience more, but you're at such hazard because you don't really understand the world. You just know you want more of it. That's essentially, you know, how Addie gets herself into some pretty complicated situations in the book, because she sees Coach's life and she wants it. She sees Coach and she wants to be her. That's such a powerful desire, and it can lead you to rather dark places if you're not careful or if you want it too badly.
But you also see the damage and the risk. There are no boundaries at all with this coach. She has the girls come over and drink with her. Plenty of risky sex. Do you know girls like this in your life? Have you?
Well, yes. I mean, I think part of that is all true to teenage girls, and part of it is really specific to some of these dynamics that can emerge with these, with the close age ranges between the coach, who, you know, they're almost peers. Though this coach, I don't think is generally representative of all cheerleading coaches. She is someone who is broken, and as you say, there's a damaged quality to her, and she doesn't really know what she's doing. There's a part of her that just loves the attention of these girls and their adulation. And she wants to make something out of them. And though they put themselves at risk, I think the girls love that they're getting this attention from her. And that, you know, what girl doesn't want to be part of a spectacle, doesn't want to be on display in a way that she's in control of?
Yeah, they're just given full rein, especially at certain times, like at homecoming, you know. They're aware that everybody makes fun of them, but suddenly they walk with their heads held high. You know, it's something that I think everybody can imagine walking down the halls of their own high school.
Right, absolutely. And what is a more noir terrain than high school, right? The stakes feel so high at that age, and everything feels, you know, power slips from your hands by an errant text message that spoils your reputation. It's such a tough age, and it's only getting tougher. And that was one of the interesting things in writing it, is delving into the teenage world of today, which is even harder than in my day.
Well, I kind of smell movie on this one, I have to say. I mean, can you imagine anyone as your ideal, Addie or Beth or Coach?
I guess one of those Fanning girls would probably be great for the for the cheerleaders. I think I did sort of picture that kind of girl. I never exactly cast in my head, but I grew up obsessed with movies, so I certainly did think with especially with all the stunts, visually how powerful they can be. And in the year of Hunger Games, it seems like finally girls are getting attention at last, which is a great thing.
Well, Megan, I really want to thank you for your time today.
Great. Thank you so much. This is wonderful.
Megan Abbott is the Edgar Award-winning author of Queenpin and The End of Everything, which is now out in paperback. Her new book is called Dare Me. For more on the book, including links to reviews, you can go to wordofmouthradio.org. Megan, thank you so much. I will admit now that when I was in junior high school, I went to cheerleading camp.
I wanted to ask, but that's awesome.
Coming up, Farewell, My Cubicle. A musical follows the anxieties and epiphanies of an unemployed office worker. Stay with us for that when Word of Mouth continues in just a moment. From New Hampshire Public Radio, this is Word of Mouth. I'm Virginia Prescott. Throughout the presidential campaign, you'll be hearing from unemployed auto workers in Michigan, out-of-work machinists in Ohio, or maybe casino workers in Nevada. They'll all be sharing stories of not being able to catch a break. We don't often hear from the office worker whose company packs up and moves, leaving them jobless with no place to go.
And we sing a happy birthday song once a month. On Happy Birthday Tuesday, I got a place to go in the morning. Going to work.
That is Ethan Lipton and his orchestra from No Place to Go. It's a show about the anxieties and driftlessness of being suddenly jobless. The show at the Public Theater in Manhattan was a critic's pick from the New York Times and is making a stop in Saxton's River, Vermont next weekend.
Man, I'm not kidding when I tell you, I love my job.
By his own description, Ethan Lipton is an emerging playwright and an old-timey songwriter, and a man who actually enjoyed his job as an information refiner. Ethan Lipton, great to have you on Word of Mouth.
Thank you so much for having me.
So did this happen to you? Did you lose your job as an information refiner?
I did. Well, information refiner is sort of a made-up job title, but basically I was a copy editor. And I worked for a company for 10 years. And it was a good job. I worked part-time, you know, maybe 30 hours a week. It became a big part of my life, I guess, as jobs do, not just because I relied on it to pay my bills, but also because I became enmeshed in the community of people there. And then at some point, the company decided that it could no longer do business here in town. And so it left and gave all of us the option of going with it. And in the piece that we do, No Place to Go, the company is moving to Mars.
No, aren't all the companies just moving to Mars these days?
Yes, yes. My company did not actually move to Mars, truth be told, but it felt like that.
You're known in New York as a lounge act. In fact, New York Magazine named you Best Lounge Act back in 2009. But there is a lot of play. There's a lot of drama in No Place to Go. There's anxiety and the kind of smooth narrative of a lounge act at the same time. How did you fuse those two things, those two parts of you?
I think that maybe they just sort of exist in me, you know, in some way that's kind of natural. One of the things we've always tried to do in the band is to kind of take funny things very seriously. I've always liked the Troubadours. As far as musicians, I've always liked, you know, Willie Nelson and Tom Waits and Leonard Cohen and all those guys who tell great stories and often have unreliable narrators. Something about this particular project was waiting to happen eventually.
Let's hear from one of the songs from No Place to Go. This is Final Sandwich, which kind of combines the silliness and the heaviness.
Dear staff,
the final sandwich keeps coming back in No Place to Go. It's left behind to congeal, advances in decay throughout the play. There is this kind of, you know, feeling of being unwanted and I guess ultimately unmissed.
Yeah, I think one of the things you realize when you work at a place for a while and then have an experience like this is that you're not really necessary in the way that you thought perhaps you were. I can't really speak for everybody, but I know that we all thought it would be there, particularly because the company we were working for was doing well. And you kind of go through these levels of denial when you find out that the company is doing what a company always does, really, which is take care of itself. Part of what is so frustrating about it and is so hard to move past is that you know you kind of don't have anyone else to blame in the end for your faith that you put in the company. My feeling is always like, what kind of a sucker would put his faith in his company? And yet I like a lot of people do.
Well, and as you mentioned, you were encouraged to do that. We're all a family. We're all in a team. We're doing this together.
Oh, yeah. I think that's always the mythology of the workplace. You think of all of these people as being the company. Then you come to this understanding that actually they're not. The company is this independent body acting on its own interests, which, of course, you always knew.
I know you're sorry you walked away. You didn't mean to be unkind, you just couldn't stay. But if you want me to go with you, this is all I can say. You can have me, I'm all yours, dear. If you
That's You'll Have to Pay from the live show No Place to Go. We're talking with Ethan Lipton. He's the playwright and singer who's singing there with the Ethan Lipton Orchestra. His show, No Place to Go, is making a pretty rare jump from Manhattan's Public Theater to Horowitz Hall in Saxton's River, Vermont, of all places, on August the 10th. It's funny, you know, it sounds like the old construct of a blues song. You're talking to a lover, but in this case, you're talking to your company.
Yeah, I mean, it is a relationship, and it supported a lot of other relationships that I have in my life. You know, it was the thing that allowed my wife and I to stay solvent, you know, in order to be in New York. If you're an artist, you know, you have to be sort of fantastically successful in order to simply make art. And so the rest of us do other things. This is a little bit of a digression, but I think when I was a young person and thinking about being an artist, I think one of the things that I obsessed about was the feeling that I was sort of different from everybody else. As I've gotten older, one of the things that I've become more and more interested in is how we're alike and how the experiences I have and the things that I'm interested in are in many ways super common.
That's interesting, Ethan, because you've been praised for a sort of not participating in the partisan hysteria about being unemployed. In fact, the tagline for the show promises that it's a show for the 100%. But I hear the song WPA, for example, and I think, maybe he is taking a stand.
Yeah, I think the show actually is very political, but I'm hoping that it is inclusive. My original hope with this piece was to write something for the people I worked with. And the people that I worked with was this very finite number. You know, they were from executives to people who were doing work that was more blue collar. And so my hope is that that community is a picture of the larger community and that anybody within that swath could find something to connect with in it.
Let's hear a bit of that song, WPA. This is from No Place to Go, the live show and the album by Ethan Lipton and his orchestra.
Did you hear what they did at the WPA? When the banks went belly up and the jobs all went away. They reinvested in America. They put the poor worker at honest pay. They built dams and roads and bridges, things that we still use today. Did at the WPA, the speculators drove the market into New York Bay. We gave a core of citizens a place to go and a chance to make some hay. They built schools and poles and airports, things that we still use today. Stomp your feet now, clap your hands. Harry Hopkins, he's our man. His art pounded to a different beat. He said even artists need to eat.
Ethan Lipton, I really want to thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me on, Virginia.
Ethan Lipton and his orchestra, who are, by the way, Eben Levy on guitar, Ian Riggs, and Vito Dieterle on saxophone, are going to be in New England. In fact, they'll be at Saxton's River, Vermont on Saturday, August the 10th. To perform No Place to Go. It's a show by Ethan Lipton and his orchestra, and it's also an album. His play Luther also opened in New York this summer, and also another play, Red-Handed Otter, will be premiering at the Cherry Lane Theater in New York City this September. So Ethan Lipton has found plenty to do with his free time. We have much more on him at wordofmouthradio.org.
Do they still make men in Brooklyn like the mighty mensch Mark Giles? Do we know who will be singing early Sondheim in the aisles?
And thanks so much for spending some time with us today. We would invite you heartily to join us in the word of mouth mission to spread new ideas to others. You can post links to segments on your Facebook page. You can retweet things that you heard to your own Twitter followers, or you can email segments to friends. Just click on over to wordofmouthradio.org and click on the Facebook or Twitter or email icons to send them along. There you'll also find a vast catalog of conversations to comb through and share. And you can listen anytime and also share anything on the free NHPR iPhone app. I'm Virginia Prescott, and this is Word of Mouth. from New Hampshire Public Radio.
Are there men who still live for their family?
Word of Mouth is produced by Taylor Quimby,
Virginia Prescott,
and senior producer Rebecca Lavoie.
Andrew Perella provides technical support.
And Dan Kogan runs our board.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals, like myself.
And not those of NHPR, its board of trustees, or its underwriters.
For information about the show, to subscribe to our podcast, post a comment, or to read our blog,
go to wordofmouthradio.org.
You can also follow us on Twitter, @wordofmouth.
Or join our community of listeners on Facebook, @wordofmouthradio.
Word of Mouth is a production.
Word of Mouth is a production.
Word of Mouth is a production
of New Hampshire Public Radio.
And if somebody tells you